Welcome back to Coast AM. I am Lisa Gar. Did you know that suicide rates increase by 10% after a celebrity commits suicide? And I personally believe one of the reasons is because the media spends so much time on the facts and the details of the case and not enough time on the conversation around prevention or understanding or compassion or listening. And that is exactly what my guest tonight is talking about. Dr. Mark Goldston knows how to listen. He's been originally a UCLA professor of psychiatry and crisis psychiatrist for over 25 years, former FBI and police hostage negotiator. And his latest book is called Just Listen: Discover the Secret of Getting Through to Absolutely Anyone. He's been in high-stakes situations, has served as an advisor on the O.J. Simpson criminal trial, and he really does have real-life experience on what it means to listen. So we will be back and joined by Mark Goldston after the break. Thank you so much. I am Lisa Gar. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I am Lisa Gar, and my guest tonight is Dr. Mark Goldston. His book is called Just Listen: Discover the Secret to Getting Through to Absolutely Anyone. That's a bold statement, Mark. And it works, doesn't it?
Well, it does. We hear this term disruption. We want to disrupt the world because things are too slow. And sadly, listening is the disruptive form of communication because people are going yada, yada, yada all the time. And when you actually listen, and one of my favorite quotes comes from a British psychoanalyst named Wilfred Bion, and he says, the purest form of listening is to listen without memory or desire. And what he means is when you're listening to another person with memory, you have like an old personal agenda that you're trying to plug them into. And when you listen to them with desire, you have a new agenda that you're plugging them into. But you're not listening to them. But can I share an anecdote which was really changed my life? And really, it's kind of the core of Just Listen. So I was a suicide specialist for, I think, over 20 years, and one of my early mentors was a fellow named Dr. Edwin Schneidman, and anyone who knows about the field of suicide will know his name. And he co-founded the Suicide Prevention Center in Washington and Los Angeles and the American Association of Suicidology. And what would happen is Ed would go up, we were both at UCLA, and he would go up to the inpatient units at UCLA. And there would be some suicidal patients who were still suicidal, but they weren't acutely suicidal, and they needed to be discharged. And the residents can choose who they want to see. The people in training can choose who they want to see, but some of these people are just too scary, and they weren't acutely suicidal, but you can't keep them there forever. And Ed would call me up, and it would always be the same phone call. He'd say, Mark, this is Ed. I'm with this lovely young woman. I'm with this handsome young man. They're in a lot of pain, Mark. You could help them, see them. And then he put them on the phone. And it's recommended when you have a psychotherapy, I was a psychiatrist practice, you should only be seeing only one suicidal patient at a time, but I think about a quarter to a third of my practice were them because Ed would refer people to me. But everything changed. I mean, when there was a patient, and I'll call her Nancy, that I was seeing, she'd made three attempts in the previous 4 or 5 years, and she'd been in the hospital 3 to 4 months every year before I started seeing her. And in those days, before people would be pushed in and out of hospitals, people would stay sometimes in the hospital for weeks to months. And I was seeing her, and I didn't think I was really helping her. I mean, she'd come in, and she'd sit there. She wasn't catatonic. She didn't really talk too much, rarely, if ever, made eye contact. And to be honest, I just felt I didn't know what was happening, except that was the longest she'd gone without a suicide attempt or being rehospitalized. And there was one weekend where I moonlighted. So often when you're just out of training, you do sometimes early psychiatrists will moonlight. So you'll cover at a state hospital, and you'll do that, and you'll be up sometimes 36 hours, sometimes 48, but you're up a lot.
Straight? You are? Wow.
You cover for the doctors in the whole state hospital, doing admissions, writing orders, and
Being up
whatnot.
48 hours?
Well, I think the most it ever was 36 hours, you know, and you'd alternate with another
Is
psychiatrist.
that
So you're
healthy when you're dealing with such sensitive subject matter?
But it's a state hospital, so you're covering and you're admitting people, so they don't necessarily come directly to you. They've already been through an emergency room. Probably isn't healthy, but you know, people moonlight to bring in some extra money, you know, when you're early in your practice. So at any rate, you know, when you've been up 36 hours, and I don't know if you've ever pulled an all-nighter in college, but when you pull an all-nighter or when you've been up that long, you know, your physiology starts to play tricks on you. Your teeth are loose, other parts of your body, which I won't mention, are loose too. You know, so you get a little bit kind of disconnected. So I'd been up a weekend like that, and then on Monday, Nancy comes in, and I hadn't slept, and she's not really making eye contact as usual. She's looking, you know, 30 degrees to the left or the right, and as I'm seated with her, suddenly, all the color in the room turns to black and white. So I'm looking out in the room, and it's black and white instead of color. And I thought, wow. And you know, and I'm kind of young and game for this. And I thought, wow, this is interesting. And then it started getting cold. I got the chills all through me, and I'm even shivering now in my shoulders as I'm remembering it. And I thought, I'm having a stroke or a seizure.
Oh, wow.
And so she wasn't looking at me, and I'm a medical doctor, so I know something about neurologic exams. So I'm there tapping my knees, you know, pointing my finger out. I'm doing a neurologic exam on myself to see if I'm having a stroke or a seizure, and she's just kind of staring, you know, at an angle from me. And after I did the exam, I thought, no, I'm all here. And then I had this crazy idea that I was looking out at the world through her eyes and feeling what she felt. So I was sleep deprived, and I blurted something out that I may not have said if I wasn't sleep deprived. And it just came out. And I said, Nancy, I didn't know it was so bad, and I can't help you kill yourself.
Wow.
But if you do, yeah, try and feel it, Lisa. But if you do, I will still think well of you. I'll miss you. And maybe I'll understand why you had to do it to get out of the pain. And I said to myself, did I think that or did I say that?
It wasn't your typical textbook response.
That's right. And I said, and I'm even doing it now. I'm wincing. I'm saying, I think I said that. And I remember saying, don't put that in the record. Don't write that one down. And I thought, I just gave her permission. And so she looked at me. It was the first time she made eye contact. And not only did she make eye contact, she looked right into my eyes. And we can talk a little bit later about how do you listen into people's eyes. But she looked right into my eyes. And I thought she was going to say, well, thank you. I'm overdue. And I got nervous. I thought I'd given her permission. I said, what are you thinking? And she really looked right through me and she said, if you can really understand why I might have to kill myself to get out of all the pain, maybe I won't need to. And then she smiled. And she, I'm remembering it, Lisa, and she smiled. And that's when I realized that, and something that I was very fortunate is that I've never worked for a salary. I mean, when I left training, I went out and I mean, you know, I would check boxes, but I didn't have to check boxes the way you do when you're working in a clinic. You got to follow protocols, and my main protocol was to do anything and everything I could to reach them and get them to a place, not where they didn't kill themselves, but where they were glad they were alive.
They were being heard. They were being listened to.
They were being felt.
They were being felt. I think it's true for anyone to feel heard. It's suicidal or not, you feel validated as a human being, recognized, present, appreciated. And even the most subtle of ways, it helps so much to hear and to not interrupt. It's very common to interrupt these days because there's so many thoughts and moments coming through our minds at all moments. But to just, yeah, that's
well, you
a
know,
beautiful
after
story.
Suicides, after Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain, I wrote a article on Medium, and it was Why People Kill Themselves, It's Not Depression. And within 5 days, it had 500,000 reads and 80,000, no, 500,000 views, I want to be accurate, and 70,000 reads. And what I talked about, and this is my experience, having been a suicide specialist, is that, yes, depression contributes to suicide. Yes, loss of a job. Yes, loss of a relationship. And I'm leaving out categorically, but this is a whole other policy matter. You know, when someone's terminally ill unbelievable pain, I mean, we're moving towards assisted suicide. As long as you screen that everything's been tried and they really only have a certain amount of time left and they're excruciating pain. So I'm leaving that out of the category. But what I said is that there's hundreds of millions, maybe billions of people in the world who are depressed. Doesn't mean they kill themselves. There's as many people who lose jobs. Doesn't mean they kill themselves. But one of the things that I've observed that they nearly always feel at the end is they feel despair. And if you break the word despair into despair, it means feeling unpaired. With hope, hopeless.
Not with human beings, but just with hope.
That's right. Unpaired with a future, hopeless,
yes,
helpless,
yes.
Powerless, worthless, useless, meaningless. And when everything lines up as if you've, instead of winning the jackpot at the slot machine, they've all lined up, you feel pointless. And what happens is you start to pair with death as a way to take the pain away. And so my view is if you compare with people in that despair, and I think what helps is when people feel felt, they feel paired with.
They feel paired, yes. And
in fact, something that I'm promoting, and I did a presentation that was very well received at in Connecticut, called the Lear Retreat, and they do an annual program on depression and suicide prevention. And so there, this was a few months ago, I launched some of my ideas and my work and my processes and programs, and I shared something that I'm now sharing with suicide hotlines, and I would love to, you know, speak to as many as I can if anyone's listening in. And that whole idea and the cornerstone of that is, how do you cause someone who's suicidal to feel felt? And I'll actually go over it. I mean, because it doesn't take that long, and we'll have, I think, enough time.
Yeah, no, I do want to, I definitely want to go over that. I just wanted to ask you about what I was talking about earlier in the beginning of the responsibility of the news media when they mention the facts and so forth. I personally feel that's irresponsible. I feel that when you have a public suicide, that the more the media talks about the facts and the idea of the why, and that seems to be a big question, why, it would be so much more responsible to start the conversation with talking about what you're talking about here. Where was there any possibility of prevention or listening or connection with the future or purpose? And I think that would make more sense. It would cause less suicides that happen around the same time, to actually open up the conversation in a different manner, just like you're doing in the field.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, the world has really become very transactional.
Yeah, that's true.
Everything's a transaction.
Yes.
Even marriages are a transaction, whether you're going to have sex tonight or you're going out to eat, and everyone's bargaining. And the way I look out at the world is you can't solve a transformational problem, which means we need to look at it differently with transactional solutions. But the world is now stuck in transactional blindness. And so part of what I'm pushing for is to offer a transformational solution, which is not about a transaction. It's about, and we'll start covering this on the other end of the break. It's doing what actually Oprah Winfrey discovered on a recent 60 Minutes episode. She was reporting on treating childhood trauma, and in 60 Minutes Overtime, she said it was the most life-changing story she's done in her entire career. So that's quite a
Why?
statement for Oprah to say.
Yes.
And she said what she saw was so effective with this treatment center is they, and these kids were acting out. It's not like they were, they were misbehaving. But their whole approach was, what happened to you that's resulted in this? And the person interviewing Oprah said, that changed things for you? And she said, it's changed everything. So I'm guessing that Oprah was aware that she could probably be a little bit judgmental, like, why did you do that? But the whole approach is, if you can really believe that something must have happened to someone,
Yes.
either recently or it sort of re-triggered something from way back when that results in this behavior. And that's how I'm trying to teach people to listen into other people, because when you believe that that's true, that the overt behavior, whether it's destructive to themselves or other people, that something must have happened to lead up to that. And if in another words, here's my approach to life. My philosophy is that I assume innocence and goodwill of everyone until I can't.
That's a compassionate approach. Yes.
And then if I can't, I don't get angry. I pause, let the person say whatever they're going to say, and I get confused, and I say, what was that about? And
Simply,
then
you
if
just
they,
say that.
and then if they get defensive, I said, and that too. And if they keep getting angry, I say, look, I've been married for 40 years. My wife has earned the right to be angry at me, and there's a lot of reasons to be, but you hardly know me. What's that about? And so it's worked out so well. And I actually spoke in Russia. I did a one-day training to the Russian Federation managers on listening and empathy, and it was a big hit. They did a highlight reel. If you look up Moscow, YouTube, Gulfstream, you'll see a 3-minute highlight reel. They didn't look at their phones for 6 hours, but I assumed innocence and goodwill, that they weren't coming there to, to watch an American make a fool out of himself. They were coming there because they wanted something other than the way they were approaching people. And when I assume goodwill and innocence, and these are managers, these are people just like American people. We're not talking political leaders here. And when I assume goodwill and innocence, they opened up to me.
And that makes sense because it's a different, it's so surprising that we have to go back to the roots of just listening and listening with compassion and silence. And it's a lost art. I get it about disruption being fast-paced and interjecting wherever you can and having a, lively, quick conversation, but it definitely is a an art that needs to be reestablished, is the art of listening and deeply listening. You were, we actually are going to take a break in just a minute, but I want to talk with you after the break about how to listen into people's eyes. And this could also have to do with anyone who's a coworker or someone who you know that might need just somebody to listen who might be going through a rough time. It doesn't have to be as extreme as the suicide conversation, but just to be there for someone. So we'll come back and really listen for that conversation. I will be right back. I'm Lisa Gar. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I am Lisa Gar. My guest is Dr. Mark Goldston. He is a former UCLA professor of psychiatry and a crisis psychiatrist for over 25 years. He has, we're talking about his latest book right now, which is called Just Listen. And you wrote a great article about the seven things that you can say to someone who is suffering. And I love this because you really have helped me with these seven words. And it really has to do with listening. But could we talk about this and how to get someone out of a place of despair?
Sure. Before we do that, because I listened to the paranormal dating plug that you put,
Yes.
and I want to put a plug for, I've created a Touched by Suicide community at my Twitter page. So it's, if you go to at Mark Goulston, MarkGoulston, there is a tweet that's up there perpetually, and it says, how many of you have known or known of someone who committed suicide? I know it's supposed to be died by suicide from your community. Middle school, high school, etc. Because I'm checking the need for an empathic-based tactical roadmap to help. It has 1.7 million impressions, 25,000 engagements,
Wow.
1,200 comments, and I'd say 70% of the comments are people just listing the people they know have killed themselves. I'd say 10 to 15% are people talking about that they've made attempts. And so I'm connecting people with each other. It's a compassionate community. It's not a clinical type thing. Someone reached out to me and they said, you know, I'm really feeling kind of worthless. And I said, reach out to someone who's having a hard time. And if they haven't posted a comment, reach out and say, hey, how are you doing? And what's going to happen? Someone's going to write back and say, you have no idea how much you helped me, and you're going to feel worthwhile.
That's
And
a wonderful
so,
way to do that, to just connect with large groups of people that way.
yeah, so I hope anyone who knows, who's been touched by suicide, and nearly everybody knows of someone, that they'll check that out. Because I just like people to know there's a place to go. And I'll tell you, I mean, people have said, you know, just being able to list all the people that they've known or people in their family, it gives relief. I mean, and some people are giving advice, but it's a little bit almost like an AA community where people just share things. So I just wanted to share that.
Is that
Again,
monitored? How do you do that?
no, it's not monitored, and I'll probably need some assistance in that because again, I don't necessarily keep track of it, and the numbers are just huge of people. So I check into it every now and then, but I guess we all have to take risks in life, and so
It's a way for people to connect,
it's a way for
like
people.
Facebook is. Yes. Okay.
Absolutely, yeah. But getting back to what you were saying,
The seven,
the
yeah.
seven words. So there's something that I've come up with that I call targeted interventional empathy. And I don't know if your listening audience, they may know something about science because they're interested in the paranormal, but they may have, or you may have heard of something called CRISPR. And CRISPR is an approach to basically genetic re-engineering, and hopefully it'll help prevent certain genetic diseases. But you go into the genes and you fix them. So my approach to suicide is there's basically empathic wounds in the psyche, spirit, and soul. It's like there's a wound there, and the wound is there probably from way back when, before you can remember, when we're all helpless, vulnerable, and powerless. We're not just fed and clothed, but stuff is poured into us. Anger is poured into us. Being ignored is not poured into us. Being overly indulged, which doesn't help us when we go out in the world, is poured into us. And when you absorb that, it can affect the way you look out at the world. And so targeted interventional empathy, which is the approach that I'm pushing out to suicide hotlines, and I was going to go into it, but the seven words, that's part of a three-step approach. But the seven words, after you've developed rapport with someone, and there's two first steps which help you develop rapport. Because, see, why you want to develop the rapport is because people who are deeply suicidal, they don't want to die. They want the pain to go away, and they have a stranglehold that's not thinking on suicide as the only way to let go of the pain. So you have to break their stranglehold on suicide. And so the seven words help that. So after you've established some rapport, which kind of loosens their grip, instead of saying to them, you know, do you feel depressed? You know, do you have guns or pills? And, you know, that's a responsible thing to do.
But those are yes or no answers.
Those are yes or no's. But if you're on the end, it's not alleviating how alone and in despair you feel.
Right.
So the way the seven words works, and you don't have to, we're not talking just about suicidal people. You can say this to your kid who just got rejected from something.
Mm.
And the seven words are, you say seven words, and they're going to say, what? And they're going to be, what do you mean by seven words? And here's the tone you use. It's a tone in which you're basically trying to elicit pus from the wound. Yeah, seven words. Hurt, afraid, angry, ashamed, alone, lonely, tired.
Right. And these are...
Pick one. And what'll happen, see, that's different than asking questions. That's why it's your intervening. Mm-hmm. And what'll happen is it creates a different connection than asking, do you feel, do you feel, do you feel? Because, mm-hmm. see, when you ask people questions, there's a gap between you and the person you're asking the questions to. It triggers a feeling, oh, there might be a right or wrong answer. Oh, there might be an answer where I can get into trouble.
So this way you're calling it out, you're bringing out, because it's
exactly.
Counterintuitive to say these things. You would want to say things that are help them or positive or help them feel better, but you're going right into the hurt, the anger, right into it.
Absolutely, because so rather than interrogating them, you're validating, and in a sense, you're assuming they feel that way, and you're not judging them, and it draws it out of them. I mean, you know, when I said to Nancy, you know, I didn't know it was so bad,
mm-hmm.
so I felt her pain. I can't help you, but I'll think well of you still if you do it. So she was feeling incredible relief, and she just started to cry with relief. And actually what I said to her, and so this is, you know, part of what I used, and I don't treat people. I've retired. I teach parents. I teach teachers. I'm open if schools want to, you know, bring me in or organization. And what I said to her, so imagine you've been, you know, she'd been in the hospital many times, seen all kinds of therapists and whatnot. So imagine you're a little cynical, and someone says to you, if it's okay with you, I'm not going to give you any advice, solutions, or treatment unless you ask for that.
It lets you have the hook, yes, of course.
Because if I do that and you don't do it, you're going to come back and feel guilty. So mm-hmm. would that be okay if I didn't do any of that? So she immediately was intrigued. She went from, you know, letting go of feeling a little suicidal to she was intrigued by that. And then I learned to, and I'll share how I learned to listen into people's eyes. And I said, what I'm going to do, I'm going to find you wherever you are and keep you company there, because you've been there at 3 a.m. too many times.
And you're okay. And you're able okay. to stay committed to that?
Yeah. It's not a literal, but what it is what I'm saying is I don't want you to be alone in the dark night of the soul at 3 a.m. So I'm committed to it by her hearing that I want to help her feel less pain as opposed to throw treatments at her.
That's incredible. Now, you've been doing this for over 25 years. How did you start off as the FBI and police hostage negotiation trainer?
No. How did you get into this? Okay, so what happened is I became the suicide specialist. This mentor of mine, Dr. Schneidman, used to teach a course called Death and Suicide at UCLA, and he would bring in guest lecturers. And so for 12 years, I was one of the guest lecturers, and I was probably the least academic, you know, hadn't written any papers, but I would do this role play, and it's actually up on, you can see an old video of me doing it on, it's on YouTube. I think it's called I'm Going to Kill Myself.
Wow.
And what I did is there'd be 250 undergraduates, and I'd go in there, take off my jacket, and I transformed myself into, I think the character's name was Jack, And I told them, you know, I'm Jack. I've never made it as far as any of you. And you can still get an A in the course, even if you can't help me. But I've had it. And then I pulled out a gun. It's on the video. And
wow.
And if you can't talk me out of it, I'm not going to get very far. And what happened in the video is, you know, in the audience is these undergraduates are all, you know, they're just riveted. And so one guy says, you know, he's kind of the hero, and he's coming up there, and he says, "You look like you need a hug." And I think it's on the video, and I said, "Oh, I really need a hug. But if you're coming up here to grandstand, and I pick up you're doing any of that, I'm going to rip your expletive throat out."
Yes.
You know, and so he's kind of hesitant, but he comes up there, and, you know, the audience is watching him, and so I'm talking to him, and the gun was on the table, so he grabs the gun, and the audience applauds. And so I say, you know, even if you're suicidal, you can have hobbies. My hobby is I collect guns, and that's my smallest one.
Huh. And you
then
do
what
this?
I do, no, then what I do is after... So I'm determined that they can't talk me out of it. And then I say, this is what you didn't ask me. This is what you didn't say to me that would have caused me to give you the gun. So how I got into the FBI thing is I started giving talks to middle school parents about reaching their kids. And there was one. So imagine this is kind of a private middle school, you know, and overprotective parents. And so there was someone from the FBI. And he said, and the title was, you know, keeping your kids safe. So I love this guy, and he just presented all the things about, you know, you need to be aware of. And I did a role play with these private school parents, and my role play was called "It's My Party, and I'll Die If I Want to."
Oh, a little shocking for them. Yes.
A little shocking, you know.
Yes.
And what I did is I played their ninth grade kid with a 4.6 acne and no social life, and I was going to go to the party over the weekend, and yes, there will be drugs, there may be gangs, and you're not calling the other parents because you've ruined my life. And so then I just agitated them, and no matter what they did, they couldn't talk me out of it. And then at the end I said, so let me see if I get this straight. You want the best for me, yes? And so my reward, if I do everything you want me to do and the way you want me to do it, is I get to grow up and be as happy as all of you are. You're right. They just started laughing.
Yeah.
And so, and then I said, this is what you could have told me. But he said, can you do some of training with our FBI and police? And so
that's how you got into it.
That's how I got into it and what I would do there. And there's actually on Vimeo something called FBI and police training. And there's a role play there where I play a suicidal cop. I take off my jacket and I have a police uniform underneath it all, and then I say, I'm the guy in your department who shot the kid with the plastic gun last year, and I've been on medical leave for a year. And I pull the gun out, put it to my neck. I said, unless you talk me out of it, I'm going on permanent leave, and then you live with the ghost of someone you couldn't save, and this time it's one of your own. And then I always pull the trigger. So I mean, they say good things, but my goal is to get them so agitated that they want an answer. But because I have this ability to tune into people, which I learned, I think, from Nancy and other people, I can actually say, this is what you didn't say to me that I needed to hear.
So you do this through role-playing so that you can really perturbate people into having the visceral experience and learning that way. I mean, it's an emotional learning experience.
Yes. So I don't leave them out on a limb, but what happens is I can get into character. In fact, John, you mentioned the O.J. Simpson trial, so I was an advisor to the prosecution, and one of the things I was able to do, and it kind of goes back to Nancy, is I could sit in the courtroom, close my eyes, and open them and look at the courtroom from anyone's point of view. The prosecution said, you know, you're really weird, but the stuff you come up with is kind of fascinating. So So they kept me out of the strategy, but I must have faxed them about 300 pages. And so, for instance, one of the things they use is during the closing argument, I said, and this is the way my mind thinks, kind of simplistic but intuitive. I said, you know, when a jury is going into deliberation, you know, the trial's over, so how do you have control over them? And I said, what you want to do is haunt them. So make sure Marsha Clark plays the 911 tapes of Nicole Brown Simpson talking about the person who killed her. You know, because the trial's so long, you know, people aren't going
Remember it, yes.
to they're not going to remember Marsha's voice and Chris Darden's and OJ didn't speak. You know, but she put that in the closing argument because that's haunting. So I was able to put myself into the jury's point of view, but you know, for all kinds of reasons, which we've discovered, it was a jury that was unwinnable for many reasons. But I'm able to put myself in people's shoes. Like really quickly, I could put myself in your shoes
Very empathetic, yes. Well,
as I listen to you, I can tell how these shows are a calling for you. You know, it's not just a job. It really matters to you that people get value. And what you're always looking for are experts who can give them something they can use immediately to make their lives better because you care. And
yeah.
probably what you're on the lookout is an expert that may have, you know, 93 books, but he or she, you know, you can't share them. He just doesn't make any sense.
Right. But I'm always trying to take care of the listener as well, so that their
Absolutely.
experience is always going to be a beneficial experience, and that we don't light anybody up without a solution. I'm
Oh
very
yeah, no,
solution oriented.
yeah,
Yeah.
yeah, and I think it comes across in your tone that you're very caring and protective, not overprotective, appropriately protective of your listeners. And you know, as you say, you don't want to light them up just to leave them hanging.
That's why, yeah, I opened the show with that irresponsible journalistic tendency for the reporters to go after just the facts without the solutions, and it's something that really bothers me. So I think that what we didn't even get to the seven words, because your stories are
No,
so
we did
fascinating.
get to the seven words. Remember the hurt? Those are the seven words.
Oh, the hurt, afraid, angry. Okay, got it. Hurt, afraid, angry, ashamed, alone, lonely, and tired. So these are the seven words that if you call them out and start talking about them, pick one and start telling me about it, you'll start to call out the feelings that are happening. They'll feel heard and less alone, and feelings start to get expressed and released.
Yeah,
Got it.
in fact, you know, I have a My Wake Up Call podcast. I just launched today with Larry King,
Wow.
and I'm very excited about it.
Congratulations, yeah.
Thank you. And what's really touching about it is because again, I don't jack some up to leave them alone. So something I know about Larry is he really wanted to be a stand-up comedian. He likes making people laugh, and he's very curious. He's one of the most curious people. And so I start the podcast, and I said, Larry, this is Wake Up Calls. So clearly, you like to make people laugh.
And we have to take a quick break.
Right, we'll
Can
finish
you,
this.
yeah, we, can we finish the story after the break? Okay, great. All right. Sorry about that. We will take a quick break, and we'll be back with Dr. Mark Goldston after the break. I'm Lisa Gar. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM.